as Jack just made very clear, if we tried to go through and talk about all of those things, we'd be here till next week. So what I thought we would do is just talk about some of the most sort of salient and kind of highlights of Professor Howard's long and storied career. We've had lunch many times, and we often talk about lots of different subjects, so I'm going to kind of go back to some of the subjects that we frequently go back to. So I want to begin with one, as I think I've told you before, one of my favorite moments in when I teach constitutional law, after I teach Griswold versus Connecticut, and we read Justice Black's opinion, I say, "And do you know who clerked for Justice Black?" And they all look at me, and I say, "Professor Howard." And their jaws kind of drop, because it's as if I said, you know, you clerked for John Marshall or someone. You know, it's like a completely different era for them. So, and that's true of these students here. They're, you know, this is a long time ago. So I wanted to curious. So you clerked for Justice Black. What was that like? And what was he like?
Yeah. Well, first, thanks to all of you for coming. I mean, this is more history than it is current events, I suspect,
yeah,
to people
exactly.
here. So thank you for your patience. And, you know, someday you can tell your grandchildren you heard from someone who in turn was at the Warren Court. And they say, was that the Marshall Court, or was it? But let me sort of take you into Justice Black's chambers this way, because I had the good fortune, when I applied for a clerkship, this was back in the days that the law school didn't really have a culture of clerkships, which of course we now do. And I applied, as one did in those days, to all nine justices, and was lucky enough to get Hugo Black's appointment. And between the time that I was given the job and the time I reported for duty, Felix Frankfurter had a stroke, left the court. Arthur Goldberg took his place, and that seat on the court went from the field marshal of the conservative ranks to one of the most liberal justices of the Warren era. And it also meant tipping the balance on the court itself. So here's Hugo Black, who for 25 years had been in dissent, some notable dissents. Suddenly he's in the majority. He's in the catbird seat. And because of his close relationship with Earl Warren, he actually could pretty much pick and choose which cases he wanted to work on. So you can imagine what an ebullient mood he was in after all those years fighting on the losing side. Suddenly he's helping make the law of the land. So, and that, you can imagine what it was like to be at the elbow of a man at that point in history. On the personal side, he was one of the warmest, most personable, nicest people you'll ever meet. I mean, he had toughness. He'd been in politics, and he knew how to struggle and how to do fights. But in terms of the relationships within the chambers between him and his other colleagues, and also between Black and his clerks, he couldn't have been warmer. And I had a taste of what it was going to be like the first day I reported for duty. I went into his chambers, and he would sit in a chair sort of like this and rock back and forth. And then we got settled, and he pointed at me and he said, "Dick, when you're working on opinions in these chambers, I want you to write not in the language of Oxford." You know, I'd been back from Oxford, and I probably thought he was lucky to have a Rhodes Scholar in his chambers. You know, people of my age at that time could get a little puffed up. At any rate, he said, you know, I probably thought I was a real find on his part. So he said, I don't want you to write in the language of Oxford. Write in the language of your country forebears. I mean, I was born in Richmond, but my people before that had been on the land. And what he was telling me was, work on drafts in a way that have accessibility, that can be read and understood. I think that's still true when you take con law and you have a Black opinion. It's in clear and cogent language compared to some of the other writing you get from the high bench. So what I found him to be was totally unpretentious, feet on the ground, wonderful to his clerks. He was a great mentor, spent a lot of time with us. And as I say, this was all buoyed along by the fact that we were on the winning side of so many big cases. Now, the Warren Court technically starts in 1953 to the end of the 60s until 69. But the Warren Court really comes to life in 1962. And the chances of fate had put me there at Black's elbow at precisely that time. I actually stayed 2 years with him. I'm not aware that he had ever asked anybody for a second year. And naturally, I thought that was a compliment. My more cynical co-clerk said, oh, well, he thinks maybe by the time you stay around for a second year, that he might get his money's worth. Right? but there I was for 2 years. Warren Court was remaking the law of the land. One person, one vote. Reform of criminal justice, the selective incorporation of the Bill of Rights, the beginning of privacy in the Griswold case and so forth. So we were really churning them out.
Were there cases, or any of those cases that you work on? Did you work on any of the big cases?
Yes, the Prince Edward County case, for example, okay. some of the others. So it was, as you all know from your study of constitutional law, just an amazing time to be there. So there I was, working very closely with Black, just not only watching the law being reshaped, but working with one of the true giants of the Supreme Court's history.
It's amazing. Wasn't he somewhat self-taught, or didn't he sort of read a lot to teach himself the law and anything else?
That's a wonderful question. Black, Alabama, he went to law school back in the days that when you didn't have to go to college. You just studied law. And so he was in Alabama politics. He was probably the leading trial lawyer in Alabama at that time, was elected to the U.S. Senate. He arrives in Washington, and then he's surrounded by these other senators who'd gone to Yale and Harvard and all the great universities. He had not. So he thought himself ill-prepared, in a sense. So he set out to read what we would call the great books, Thucydides and Polybius and the later classics like Gibbon and Carlyle, all the books you're supposed to read, but you never get around to it, you know, the books I'm talking about. So he was really, in that sense, self-taught. And then what happened? He started lending me these books. Well, I didn't mind that until I discovered he expected me to read these books and have conversation. I was going to stick them in the trunk of the car, go off to the beach and not worry about it, but I was wrong. So we would work on weekends in his house in Old Town Alexandria, he had this amazing library surrounded by the great books of history. And we'd take a break, and I would pull some of these books off the wall, open them up, and you'd find them heavily annotated in the margins. There was kind of a conversation between Hugo Black and these great authors of history. And he would write things like nonsense or rubbish, or just plain no, exclamation mark. I mean, you could see an actual conversation going on. So I'd read something. I'd never read Polybius, for example. There I was. But what I finally decided, reading those books, was that Justice Black was the last person on the U.S., last justice on the U.S. Supreme Court who read the same books that the founders wrote. That's the kind of education you had in the late 18th, early 19th century. And if you read Black's opinions, there's a love for the Constitution and for its history and its founding principles that I think is peculiar to the modern court. Which, by the way, gave him an advantage on his colleagues who were not, as it turned out, as well-read as he was.
Yeah, I can see why not. And you worked on Gideon versus Wainwright, is that right?
I did indeed. I mean, all of you. Is there any other case other than Marbury versus Madison which will forever be in the case books? I mean, they come and they go, don't they? But Gideon will always be there, both for what it held itself, you know, the right of counsel in cases, felony cases where you're not able to afford a lawyer, but also because it's the sort of lodestar of that line of cases in the 60s in which the Warren Court, one amendment at a time, did selective incorporation. I mean, Black never sold four other colleagues on wholesale incorporation. Right. That never happened, but he kept winning so many battles, he basically won the war. So Gideon, I think, stands as there's an intersection of equal protection and due process in that case, a very creative use of the Constitution.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so then after clerking, you come to teach here, and I want to get to teaching and teaching constitutional law. But one of the most interesting things about your career is that you then fairly quickly got somehow roped into, I mean, that's what Jack mentioned, into the Virginia was ratifying the Constitution, and they came to Charlottesville to look for you. How did that?
That was interesting. The governor, Mills Godwin, this is one of the great mysteries of Virginia history. It's a bit of an enigma in that Mills Godwin, as a state senator, had been one of the architects of massive resistance back in the bad old days before, just after Brown versus Board. he morphed in a way into being a progressive governor, and he asked the assembly for authority to appoint a commissional constitutional revision to rewrite the Virginia Constitution. The 1902 Constitution was just laden with racism. It was a white supremacy constitution. The time was right for so he appointed a commission made up of extraordinary group of people. Lewis Powell, who later sat on the U.S. Supreme Court, Hardy Dillard, later sat on the World Court at The Hague, Oliver Hill, who was the Thurgood Marshall of Virginia, the leading civil rights attorney of that of the Brown period, and a number of others, Colgate Darden, former UVA president, former governor. And so
Darden?
Yes, Darden, right, yeah, okay. The Darden School, named for Colgate Darden, exactly. So this is a, if there's ever been a blue ribbon commission, this was the one. It was also bipartisan. There was a former candidate for governor on the commission, Ted Dalton. So anyway, here are the heavyweights. Fine, they've all got full-time jobs. They're all busy. They can't sit down and do all the drafting, so they need a draftsman. And I was the kid on the block. I had just joined the faculty. I was only a couple of years into teaching. It may have been Hardy Dillard's idea, because Hardy was dean of the law school.
Okay.
He was dean of the law school. I had been one of his students. So he probably said, have no fear, I have the fear, I have the right man for you. I don't know the back story of this, but all I know is they came to me and they said, we need an executive director, basically a draftsman. Well, you know how young professors are, you're taught by them. They can do anything, right? Write a constitution, piece of cake. I mean, you want to write a constitution? I can do that. Well, what was I thinking? That it was like writing a will or a deed, and you just go to the form book and just copy out "We the People of," fill in the blank. You know, I don't know. So I mean, I was convinced in my. I said, "Sure, I can do that for you." Well, what I didn't tell them at the time, indeed not even later, I had never read the old Virginia Constitution. I didn't know what was in it. I didn't know beans about state constitutions. If any of my professors talked about a state constitution, I don't remember it. Maybe I skipped class or nodded or something, but I don't recall it. The world of state constitutions was unknown to me, but I said, sure, I can do that. So they hired me. And boy, did I learn a lot in that process, as you can imagine.
So what were the big issues that, I mean, you had to get rid of the white supremacy aspect.
Exactly.
Besides that, or was that the big issue?
I think the single biggest issue was education.
Okay.
Because we had segregated schools, of course.
Okay.
We had...
So this is what year now we're talking?
This is 1968.
Okay.
If you ever have a chance in the law library, pull out the volume of debates of the 1902 Constitution. You will not be surprised, but you'll be shocked anyway, by the white supremacy, the Anglo-Saxons. There's no place in Virginia for blacks as part of the political process. They belong on the plantation. I mean, just terrible stuff. And by the way, one out of three of the members of the 1902 convention had studied law at UVA. Think about that for a leg. Anyway, that was the constitution that we had to junk and write basically a new constitution. So centerpiece was education. Prince Edward County, among other places, had just closed their schools. That, by the way, among Hugo Black's cases, I was at his elbow, helped him write the case that ordered Prince Edward County to reopen and fund their schools. It was actually the first Supreme Court case with an affirmative decree, not what the court states could not do, but what they must do. That was a real watershed when you think about it. So at any rate, the state constitution had to be rewritten to put the age of closed schools and segregation behind us. And so I think the education article is the most important one, because it decrees that the General Assembly shall maintain a state system of education for every school child of school age, and the counties are under a constitutional mandate to do their part. So if another county tried to not do their part, the Attorney General could take them to court and mandamus them to live up. So
and did they? Did he or did they?
And that's worked. That now that doesn't sound like a big big change. I mean, in today's world, you say, of course, that's the norm. It was not the norm back in the 1960s. So we put education in the Bill of Rights for the first time.
A right to education.
A right to education is an affirmative right in Virginia. I could do a separate lecture on what happens to state constitutions when the courts get a hold of them. Because, I mean, all of you know, the drafters can do whatever they please, but the courts have the final word. You know, if I've been in cases in Richmond, arguing or on the brief on cases, they don't care what Professor Howard thinks. Just because I was there means nothing to them. They will decide what the Constitution means. So that, but that's really another story. So education was really the centerpiece. We reformed the judicial system, which was really kind of a mess. It was a thorough rewrite, but with an awareness of political limitations.
Yeah.
There were things we wanted to do. Dillon's rule ought
very
to be reversed, but the legislature won't do it. Constitutional officers ought to be...
So you tried to change the Dillon rule?
We recommended that, but curiously enough, I mean, the
legislature... Do you know what that is? You want to just explain?
Dillon's rule says that the powers of localities, cities, and counties are strictly construed. They only have the power expressly given to them in state law. And it's a 19th century sort of a tightrope for localities. And we thought we were doing the legislature a favor by reversing Dillon's rule so they wouldn't have to be bothered with revising the city charters or the county rules or the like. But they would they decided differently. Apparently, legislators like being minor potentates in their own little kingdom. They like members of the board or the city council coming to them hat in hand and asking for favors. That makes you feel like somebody. So I guess I learned something not only about drafting, but about the political dimension of state constitutions.
Well, that was what I was going to ask. So then were you also involved? So you were the draftsman. Were you all, did you then have to... Was it hard getting it actually ratified?
Well, there were really...
What has to happen? Just go through the General Assembly and then...
Exactly. There were really three stages. Drafting, the commission's work, the General Assembly, legislative approval or revision of the commission's proposals, and then finally, referendum, popular approval by the people. And having done the drafting, I was then invited to Richmond as the counsel to the legislature as they did their work. And I felt like the one-armed paper hanger, because all the committees were meeting, this one on local government, that one on finance, and so forth. And I was running around from one to another, trying to explain politely in a way, but also trying to sell what the commission, you can imagine, I had some vested interest. And that thrust me in the middle of politics, where legislators, for example, deciding, we in Virginia still have we're the only state in the country where the governor can't run for re-election, the one-term rule. Mississippi was the next to last, and we're not usually behind Mississippi, but now we are. But the legislators like the one-term rule because the governor turns over every 4 years, right? And they will tell you, oh, the governor's got too many powers already. Right. So that leads me to comment that even in the commission, we recognized the things which it was unlikely that the legislature would do. And therefore, rather than risk the whole enterprise by putting in things we knew couldn't pass, we say, and of course with commissioners like the ones I named, they knew what to stay away from, which was big, big help.
They had a good political sense of what was...
The year before we did our revision, Maryland had a convention, a good government convention, the League of Women Voters kind of people. And they put it to referendum. But what they did, for example, they took out all the constitutional officers became statutory. You know, the sheriff and the commissioner of revenue, all those people don't need to be in the statute, but they like being in the statute. So in Maryland, when they took them out, that created a center of opposition to the new constitution in every county in Maryland. And so it lost. It was voted down. It was voted down in some of the Eastern Shore counties in Maryland, like by 8-1.
Oh my God.
And so I carried that story back to my commissioners in Virginia. I said, whatever you think about that, that's a third rail. Don't touch it. And so that was put aside, not on the merits, but because of political realities.
Yeah. And then when it went to the people, do you remember what the vote was?
Oh my goodness. I was then, Linwood Holton by then was governor. he asked me if I would run the referendum campaign. I'd just as I'd never written a state constitution. What did I know about politics? I hadn't run for anything. I hadn't helped people. I mean, I'd done poll work and stuff, but nothing important. But I agreed to do it, so I took leave from the law school and got on the road and went all over Virginia from Big Stone Gap on the one end to Nancock on the other, making talks, black churches, union halls, suburban women's clubs, anybody who would like to hear about the Constitution. And talk about an education. I was born and raised in Richmond. I knew Tidewater. I knew Charlottesville. I'd been a little bit west. I didn't know Southwest Virginia. I didn't know the South Side areas. But I went into, I tried to speak at least once in every county and city. And there are 130 of them, so I covered a lot of ground. And it was, for example, my first encounter with conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Something we're all familiar with, yeah.
Conspiracy, everybody knows what they are now, but we were on the fringe of that era back in the 1970. I remember, for example, a meeting we had in Colonial Heights, Virginia. It's between Richmond and Petersburg, and in a sense, it's where Southside Virginia starts. I gave my talk. In the front row, there was this very dour-looking chap with a recording device, one of those old tape recorders. His look on his face told me he was not doing that because he liked what I had to say. He also had brought with him a logo that looked like the logo of the United Nations. You can picture that in your mind. It had movable parts, so with a couple of twists of the wrist, the United Nations logo became the hammer and sickle of the Soviet Union.
Naturally.
And I thought to myself, what does that have to do with anything? Well, his point was that this proposed constitution could not have been written in Virginia. It was too radical, too crazy. Virginians would never do this, so therefore it must have been written in Beijing or Moscow, right? Or worse yet, New York or Chicago. But it certainly wasn't local. So there was the conspiracy theory. In Southside Virginia, for example, busing was a big issue at that time. This is about the time of Charlotte Mecklenburg. Okay. So busing was, especially in Southside, where you have a larger black population. And so down there, I was really up against a lot of opposition. We, in the final referendum, we lost several counties on the North Carolina line, yeah. Mecklenburg and Brunswick and Prince Edward, Charlotte, some of the others. But we won big statewide. Okay. We got 72% of the vote.
Wow.
And if you were running for office, that would be a mandate, wouldn't it? We got 85% of the vote in Fairfax County. Lexington gave us 85%. It began to look like a Bulgarian plebiscite at that point.
Well, okay. Well, that's a nice segue there, speaking of Bulgaria. Okay, so you come back from that. You're now back here in Charlottesville teaching, doing your thing. Fast forward almost 20 years,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
88,
that's right.
89?
Right.
Okay, so before you go to Eastern Europe, but maybe again, because, you know, I was basically a kid when this happened.
Yeah.
Can you set the stage a little bit, yeah, sort of geopolitically, what's going on in 1989 and the world and
I tried
Europe?
To get as my interlocutor an older member of the faculty who would actually know what went on back then. So
yeah.
So you have to learn it up as you go, don't
yeah,
you?
Exactly.
So this is a fast forward. I did consult some American states in the meantime. Alabama.
So you're developing a little bit of a profile as a
constitution
guy.
And if I thought Virginia was a hard sell, try to rewrite the Alabama Constitution or the Oklahoma Constitution. Oklahoma has its original 1907 Constitution, in which there's a provision that defines the flashpoint of kerosene. Why? Because they don't trust the legislature to get it right, so they put it in the Constitution. So I,
oh, yeah,
I mean, just in Louisiana, the bridge over the Mississippi at New Orleans is forever the Huey P. Long Memorial Bridge. So anyway,
right.
Read your state constitution sometime. So at any rate, I had some practice advising other states. Hope Alabama and Oklahoma did not rewrite their constitutions. So it's now the late 80s, 1989. You've obviously read about this. And when the Berlin Wall came down, then the communist empire in Central and Eastern Europe began to unfold, because suddenly the leaders of communist parties in that area realized that this time if they tried revolution or reform, the Russian tanks were not coming in. That was the big moment. Started in Poland with solidarity and the labor movement, Wałęsa's movement there, and it spread very quickly like a cancer from the communist perspective to the other states in the region. So it was one of those moments like the French Revolution, like Philadelphia in America. It's one of those moments of authentic transformation taking place, and I was lucky enough to be drawn into it.
And you just got a call and said, hey, who was the first one to call you?
You know, I will never know who had the idea, but I had just chaired a Smithsonian International Conference on the bicentennial in 1987. And so this international transition was taking place right on the heels of that. That may be where they got my name, but at any rate, I got a call from the State Department. A delegation of Hungarians who were meant to revise the Hungarian Constitution were in the country. Could I have them come down here and do a seminar on what do you do when you write a constitution? So I said, sure, send them down. They were, I don't know if you've been to Budapest or not, but the chairman of this delegation had an opera cape like this. And it was straight out of a Franz Lehár operetta. So I said, these people aren't serious. This is a communist country. They want to do a Potemkin village. They're not going to write a real constitution. But I said, I'll enjoy having them. Bring them on. We spent 2 days talking. They seemed to like the experience. So then Hungary's parliament then invited me to go to Budapest. Well, I love music and art and all that stuff. I said, I'll have a great time in Budapest, even if they're not real about this. But I arrived in Budapest, and I saw students that set up tables in the subways and that sort of thing, handing out literature on why change was inevitable. And I said, if that's happening out in the open, something is going on here.
Yeah.
So I then was invited back several times by the parliament, treated like, my goodness, professors don't get treated. They have a guest
house. I can
vouch
for that. Yeah.
Oh, my, exactly. You and I know about that. I had to go to Budapest to a communist country to be treated like a capitalist. I loved it. So I really, and I love Budapest. I think Hungary has the most amazing history. So I worked with the Hungarians, and sure enough, see what I think their mind, Hungarians are very quick at a lot of things. This old saying that a Hungarian will go in the revolving door behind you and come out ahead of you. That ain't easy. I think the Hungarian communists saw change coming. They wanted to ride it out and take and get credit for it.
I see.
So I worked with the Hungarian. Then, and this is a mystery to me too, my name got around in some other countries. And I'll never know, as if I put a shingle out, Howard does constitutions, you know, or something. So I got calls from Warsaw and from Prague and various other, maybe 8 or 10 countries altogether.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay. And
including Albania.
Oh, wow.
I had to look on the map to find Albania, you know. So, and what, but I did most of the work in Prague and Budapest and Warsaw. They were the three most intensive. And it ranged from sort of general sessions, seminars, that sort of thing, to actually taking part in the drafting.
And so what were, I had the same question about those as about the Virginia. What were the big issues for them?
Well, first place you had to junk, they had beautiful constitutions based on the Soviet Constitution of 1976. And you just read them, and it was the good life, every right you could imagine.
Yeah, right,
but of course,
right,
it was a joke.
Paper rights,
Paper rights. Everybody knew those constitutions were not enforceable. So among the major questions was enforceability.
Yeah.
How do you write a constitution and make it stick? And there I thought, I said, there are really a couple of dimensions. One is the institutions that you create, like
structural,
a constitution, the structural changes. But the other, the cultural change. How do you get people who've lived for generations under communism to not treat law as a joke? Because in the old days, it was not the law, it was who you knew.
Right.
So the cultural part would take a long time. I figured my job there was to just remind them of that, but help them put the structures in place.
Yeah.
And to give, since all of you know Marbury versus Madison, I remember a meeting I had with Czech and Slovak judges and some lawyers at a meeting in Bratislava, which is today the capital of Slovakia. And we were talking about enforcement of the Constitution.
Yeah.
And I was sort of being an American, culturally acclimated to Marbury. I was talking about, well, I assume you have the Czech lands and you have the Slovak lands. And these are very distinct cultures. I mean, the Czech lands are more advanced, more progressive, more liberal. The Slovak lands are more conservative, more rural, more reluctant to change. So at the table, we're talking about constitutional enforcement, and I was suggesting, of course, the Constitutional Court of Czechoslovakia will have power to enforce rulings, to review and oversee the courts of the Prague, of the Czech lands and the Slovak lands. And when I said that, the president of the Slovak Supreme Court, a big bear of a mountain, oh my goodness, he's like a caricature out of a movie. When I said what I did, he slammed his fist down on the table and said, that will not do, absolutely not. That will violate our sovereignty. Sovereignty. I thought this was like one country, you know.
Have I got the wrong place?
And we made that argument in Virginia back in the 1860s and got our wrist slapped, right?
Yeah.
Fought a civil war over Calhounian type. This was John C. Calhoun in wearing Slovak clothes. What the Slovaks were doing, their mindset was that they were not rewriting the Constitution, they were writing a treaty between sovereigns. And think of that. That is so like the antebellum South, where they were saying it's a treaty among states, and if we want to secede, we can.
Yeah.
So that had a certain familiar ring to it. So one thing I carried away from that experience was understanding how important it is when you make, interpret, and enforce a constitution to think about the history, the tradition, the culture of the particular people that produce it. And in Central and Eastern Europe, small countries, you think they can't be that different, but they are.
Yeah. Okay, well, so how do you look back on that? I mean, one of the things that I love that I remember you saying is one of the young guns in Hungary, right? One of the liberals was none other than the current.
Viktor Orban, today's prime, all of you read about him all the time.
About Orban,
I met him when he was a 26-year-old graduate student. In those days, he was a liberal. He had accepted George Soros' money to have a scholarship to study in England.
Can you imagine what Fox News would be saying about that?
And that's sort of, politicians do change their mind, but not many have changed as much as he has, because he had a party named Fidesz, and in the first open election, they did very poorly.
Okay.
So I think the wind's blowing the other way. So he morphed quickly into being an illiberal. He's the one who coined the phrase illiberal democracy. Illiberal democracy has become very common. So as you know, if you follow the news from Hungary today, well, let me step back a moment. After my work in Budapest, I take no credit for anything they did. I simply happened to be there, part of the conversation. But I used to use Hungary as an example of the success of constitutionalism in a post-communist country. It had a constitutional court, which in many ways was as strong and respected as the German constitutional court, which is a very strong court. That's all gone now. Orban and his party have stripped the court of its powers. They even passed a bill that allowed Parliament to cancel any decision of the constitutional court. Boy, we have people in our Congress who would love to have that kind of power, as you know. And he's dismantled the free press, the state media. He's handed out money to all his cronies. I mean, it is a backward slide from where it was after 1989.
Is the same thing happened in Poland, or not as bad?
Poland, the same, but not quite as bad.
Okay.
There's more hope for Poland at this point.
And how do you interpret that? Is it what you were saying before? Do you think it's just about something about the culture? Or, you know, the sort of life under Soviet rule caught up with it in some way?
It's partly the culture, but you know, there's also, especially in Hungary and Poland, they are able to play, as some American politicians do, on the sense of victimization, of being disrespected, of being on the outside, not being part of the mainstream.
Okay.
The elites don't understand us. You all understand that sort of rhetoric. And in Poland, for example, when the Ottomans reached the gates of Vienna back in several hundred years ago, when the Western Europe felt itself under threat, the leader of the Christian forces who stopped the Ottomans at the gates of Vienna was a Polish king.
Oh.
And so that's part of Polish history. And then so the Poles say, all these centuries we've been on the front lines protecting Western civilization, Christianity, and what kind of respect do we get? These people in Brussels don't understand us. And it's that that victim card is played. In Hungary, the card they play is that the Trianon Treaty in 1919, Hungary happened to be on the wrong side of that of the First World War. So in the Versailles settlement, Hungary lost something like two-thirds of its territory.
Okay. It was the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
From the the Austro-Hungarian Empire dissolved at that point. Hungary was dismembered because they'd been part of the empire. There are something like a million Hungarians today living outside of Hungary. So Viktor Orban and his party are able to use Brussels and George Soros and the liberal elite in general as being people. They don't understand us. We owe them nothing. Yeah. And that works as a matter of politics. That on top of Hungarian culture.
Oh, wow. It's sad to see.
And it really is sad. Some of you may know of or even have read Francis Fukuyama's book published in the early 90s, The End of History. And Fukuyama predicted that the world was headed towards its destiny was liberal democracy.
Right.
Now, it would take more time in some places, like Russia, obviously, China, of course, but he saw this convergence on the liberal democratic principle. Nobody talks that way anymore, including him.
Yeah. Yeah, right, exactly.
Including, he's recanted on that.
Yeah. More like the clash of civilizations and clash of a lot of other things.
Exactly.
Okay, well, so then bringing back here, how did you, so let's go, in a way, going back in time. So how do you feel like you got into teaching in the first place?
Maybe. Well, that's interesting. I came from Richmond. Nobody in my family had been a lawyer. And I knew some lawyers vaguely through college and otherwise, but I didn't really know much about the law. I was not a law junkie. Went to college, wasn't quite sure what I would major in, wound up finally, had splendid professors in history and government.
At University of Richmond.
University
right?
of Richmond.
Yep.
And wound up having a double major in history and government. Well, the 4 years come and they go. You have to do something for a living, right? I couldn't stay an undergraduate forever. So I got to thinking about law. But I was in the Army for 2 years. This was in the 50s when the Korean War had never ended. It was there was an armistice, but I had signed up for the ROTC. That sent me down to Fort Eustis, Virginia, near Williamsburg. We had the same branch of ROTC as the University of Virginia did.
Okay.
So in the officers' training corps at Fort Eustis, I met a lot of UVA graduates who, like me, had been commissioned as an officer. And several of them were coming to law school up here. So they're through the influence of the University of Virginia, I was sort of swept. I said, yeah. I think that's where I'll go to law school. Excuse me.
And at this point, it's over at Clark Hall, right?
So we're over in Clark.
Before
I hope you've been in Clark Hall. No, you shouldn't go in there because you'll be sad about what could have been.
It's
most beautiful, but gosh, it's a wonderful building.
Yeah.
So anyway, I came to law school up here, and my plan was to go back to Richmond and join a law firm. I had known Lewis Powell when I was growing up. I actually argued a Supreme Court case where he was on the bench, and for some reason it crossed my mind that I had dated one of his daughters. I didn't need to be thinking about that. In oral argument, you're supposed to, you know, clear your mind out and be focused like a laser beam. But I talked the Tidewater accent he's got, so I got his vote, by the way. We won. So at any rate, I was going to join a firm, probably Lewis Powell's, or I assume it was the white shoe firm of that day and age. I did practice briefly in Washington, Covington and Burling, but then I got this clerkship with Justice Black, and as I said, spent 2 years with him, and I was sucked into the world of constitutional law, the Supreme Court. I mean, it was such a glittering place to be. I think I was spoiled for private practice, and it became increasingly clear to me that whatever others might do, that I was not going back to join a law firm. Well, then so much of my lifetime has been happenstance, just good things happen that I'm not really in control of. I got a Hardy Dillard Right. Again, I feel like he was my good angel. I got a call from Hardy Dillard. Would you like to think about teaching? And I was already sort of thinking about, yeah, I think maybe I ought to be thinking about the academic world. Well, here I get this call from the dean of the law school, who in those days probably was the appointments committee.
Yeah. Yeah, I was about to say, it does not work that way anymore.
That's right.
Exciting. You don't just get calls.
Today I would have to do a workshop and people would read all my papers and on and on and on, you know, this sort of thing. But in the, this is a different age in which Hardy Dillard probably said, oh, we need a space to fill. Who shall we get? Let's call Dick Howard and see if he'd like to come and teach. So I said, yeah. Yeah. I think I'll try that. And I knew if I didn't like teaching, I could go back into practice.
Right, right.
But I said, I'll get, I love Virginia. I had such a good time at the University of Virginia in my law school days.
Yeah.
So you have to imagine, this is almost like the Middle Ages. When I joined the faculty at that time, I was the 22nd member of the faculty.
Ever.
Ever. Not ever, but one man law school.
Yeah.
But
wanted to make sure. Yeah.
That's how small the faculty was. We were, I don't know, 500 or so students and the like. And I'm sure what their theory was, okay, somebody has died or retired, moved on. We have a space to fill. We need a warm body who's fairly smart to fill that space. No question about what are you good at? What would you like to do? Do you just want to teach? Okay, so I accepted. I came. And I taught constitutional law, which made a lot of sense. I mean, that was an obvious choice on my part, but they needed somebody to teach the law of evidence.
Yeah, body of law. Yeah.
Yeah, I had done appellate work. I'd never been in a trial courtroom in my life, in any capacity. What did I know about hearsay?
Yeah.
I mean, so...
Hasn't stopped me, but
so
yeah.
didn't stop... Well, your path, you surely weren't as ignorant of it as I was.
But actually, this is interesting to me because this would have been pre-federal rules of evidence.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
Yes.
It would have been early
much more common law.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so of course, I wanted the job. So that I also taught legal philosophy, and I'd done philosophy at Oxford, very different, frankly, from philosophy in this country. But still, it made me sound like I could do it. So I did that. But evidence... I was one chapter ahead of the students all the time, you know, kind of making it up, and they knew it. They knew I didn't know anything about evidence, but being University of Virginia students, they were civilized and polite and put up with me. And I tried gimmicks sometime. One day at the end of class in evidence, there was a chap in the front row, Coatsworth Pinckney from Richmond.
Oh,
how about
that
for a name? The Pinckneys were among the signers of the Declaration of Independence in South Carolina. Anyway, I said, Mr. Pinckney, go home tonight and read Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Come in tomorrow, be prepared to talk about Mark Antony's speech from the steps of the Capitol building. And of course, students are all looking at each other saying, oh dear God, Professor Howard has taken leave of his senses. This has nothing to do with evidence. But I said, come in tomorrow with prepared to tell us what that speech has to do with evidence. Well, as all of you know, it's the speech in which Mark Antony holds up Caesar's bloody tunic, you know, here, envious, Brutus's, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so it's like prosecutors used to do with their bloody shirts.
Yeah.
You know, the victim's clothes would be brought into the... It's incredibly prejudicial because it makes you forget that the question is, did this person do it? You're so awed by the evidence that juries go off the rails. So he comes in the next day dressed in a toga.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
And with a toga for his professor. Well, at this point in the play, of course, Caesar is dead. So I was stretched out on the desk in the classroom. And the whole thing was so funny. The corpse was rocking with mirth. Now, so for years after these people graduated, they remembered that day. They would they forgot everything else I taught them, but they remembered that day. So if I'd had a gimmick for each hour of class, it would have been a spectacular success.
Okay, well, so that leads...
That's the law of evidence.
I want to ask you about what your scholarship was, but that's a natural segue to something that I am curious about, which is, so you can actually sort of imagine something like that happening today. How has the student body changed over that time?
Oh, that's very interesting.
We're talking late 60s to now early 20s.
Okay. You know, I've done no statistical study of you know, the people who are here versus then. We were a bit smaller. So that's one obvious change. But in terms of the students themselves, I think I was a very typical University of Virginia law student in those days. From Richmond, white, Anglo-Saxon, all the rest of it.
There were women, right? Just not very many of them, right?
That's okay. First change is gender. I mean, women were admitted and did come, but only a handful.
Yeah.
Because the women's rights movement in this country really took off in the 70s, right? That's when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was arguing the six cases of which she won five in the U.S. Supreme Court. And of course, the number of women in law school just rocketed from that point to something near parity today. So one difference was gender. Second would have been race and ethnicity. Black students were admitted, but there were only a handful at that time. Not many Asian students. You have to think about the change in the American popular demography generally, that in the mid-20th century, it was much more nearly white, Protestant, Anglo-Saxon than it is today. So the student body mirrored that. It was a more southern school. I mean, there were, of course, students from all over the country. Virginia was already becoming a national law school in those days, but I think it's become more national since then. I don't recall that they had ratings then. But so difference in gender, difference in race and ethnicity. I mentioned the lack of a culture of clerkships. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that I was the third UVA graduate to have a clerkship at the U.S. Supreme Court. I could think of one, John Rhinelander the year before me, and Barrett Prettyman in the late 50s before that. And of course today, as you know, we regularly place students, I mean, all over the country, but some years as many four clerks at the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, I think the notion of what students wanted to do directly after law school has changed enormously. And this is more subjectively, but I think students come to the law school today having lived in a much larger world than what I lived in at this time. I mean, I had a good education. I mean, I loved my courses. I followed foreign affairs and all that. But today's students, I think, simply know more about the world they live in and have probably done more in this country and abroad than was true of my generation. And that's partly because it's hard to find a decent university that doesn't have internships and programs and study abroad, that they encourage people to go abroad for a semester or a summer. So people came to the classroom then, I think, simply less sophisticated, or at least less aware of the larger world. I don't think there was a profound difference in quality. I mean, my students, I'm prepared to accept that some of my students are smarter than I am, okay? But I've got experience, seasoning it's called. I keep the ball moving so that they don't stop long enough to think, well, you know, he's not that smart. I'm just not going to give them time to think about that. I think probably the median of students here has risen. I mean, we're more selective than we were, I mean, for lots of good reasons.
Because they say, you know, every year at graduation, they say this is the best class.
Exactly, inevitably, and they will say it again this year.
Yes, exactly.
Count on that.
What about the subject? I mean, you taught constitutional law. Obviously, the issues there have changed over time, what the hot topics were. Has that seemed like, or has it always been race and gender and things
well,
like that?
Well, think about, we've had the Warren Court, the Burger Court, the Rehnquist Court, the Roberts Court, right? Four chief justices. And it's convenient, sometimes misleading, to assume that constitutional law's evolution tracks those four courts. But in a rough sense, it has. I mean, when Earl Warren stepped down, Richard Nixon famously campaigned against the Supreme Court. You know, elect me as president and I will put judicial conservatives on the Supreme Court. He had four vacancies to fill, what, in 2.5 years? Wow. Rehnquist and as Chief Justice, Berger as Chief Justice, and then Blackmun and Powell and Rehnquist. But I think in many ways, to respond to your question, I think the way I've thought about and taught constitutional law has really tracked the changes in the court itself. And of course, in the country at large, I mean, the court doesn't change unless politics makes it possible for presidents to appoint the people that they do. But I think the moment I stepped into the classroom, right, at the on the heels of my clerkship, was precisely the point that the Supreme Court was remaking the Constitution and the country at large. I mentioned one person, one vote, and criminal justice, and even the first glimmerings of the right to privacy. Griswold, for example, was in the 60s. So the field was exploding. There were so many areas into which the court was going. It was constitutionalizing so much of American life. I mean, one concrete example, privacy, libel law.
Oh, right, right.
Until New York Times versus Sullivan, privacy law was simply, I mean, libel law was a matter of state law, right? Well, New York versus Times versus Sullivan brought it within the ambit of constitutional law. And you can go through so many areas of American life: school integration, prison reform, mental hospitals, gender equality. I mean, there's so many of them that became really the warp and woof of constitutional law from about the 60s onwards. Manifestly increased by the Burger Court.
Yeah.
The counter-revolution that people predicted never happened. The Burger Court did more of what the Warren Court did. I mean, judges had more work to do in the 70s from what the 60s were. And then, as I say, in my teaching and thinking about constitutional law, I was always obviously aware of the court. And then in the 80s, the Reagan years,
right,
some changes begin to set in. The Federalist Society is appointed, is created. In that you start having conservative public interest law firms like the liberals, ACLU, NAACP had, as Lewis Powell put it in his memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, they're eating our lunch. And so the conservatives started creating groups like the Pacific Legal Foundation and the like. And of course, nominations were changing after the Bork hearings, 1987, and also the appearance of originalism.
Right.
In the Warren Court, nobody talked about, in fact, the Warren Court was not very philosophical. They just kind of did the right thing, you know, just looked at a problem, it needs to be fixed, here's a way to fix it. They were not much about jurisprudence, and that really, once Scalia got on the bench in 1986, and on the Supreme Court bench, then originalism becomes part of the, whether you liked it or didn't like it, it was an inevitable part of the discourse. And then finally, as you turn into the 21st century, up to that point, there had not, since the Warren Court, been a working majority. You had sort of floating different factions beginning to coalesce around Rehnquist in the late 90s, but you had the moderates on the court. You had Lewis Powell, you had Sandra Day O'Connor, you had Anthony Kennedy, always keeping the court from just lurching to the right. So then finally, of course, after Roberts becomes Chief Justice, Alito comes to the court, Kennedy leaves the court soon thereafter, and finally you get the, as you know, the supermajority on the Supreme Court. I mean, one could write books about those last 2 minutes, but my point is, with each generation on the court, with each change of the faces on the court, and the jurisprudence that comes with it, that obviously affected how I teach. I mean, my teaching of constitutional law is probably unconventional in the sense that I put a lot more history and personality into it than perhaps other people.
Well, that relates to, we're almost out of time, and there are two questions I want to make sure to get to. One is just that one interesting thing about your career is that your career represents a kind of model of being a law professor that is in some ways, you know, vanishing, which is someone who's really engaged in public life and public service. And I'm curious, I know you started out writing about Magna Carta, a form of constitution.
Right.
Do you feel like have they affected each other? Like, do you think of them as part of the same thing, or do you just view them as sort of separate?
Yeah, spheres? That's interesting. I think in the academic world, in the law academy, we talk about scholarship and teaching and service. When I started teaching, I think I was pretty much at liberty to do whatever I liked. And it just happened partly because of the writing of the Virginia Constitution.
Yeah.
I sort of, as it were, got drawn. I liked it, something I cared about, but had a chance to do it from the very beginning. I think it was easier to do that 50 years ago. I think it was easier to write and teach and then do public service. And now I think law schools typically have clinics. We have very good ones here. They do a wonderful job, but they become sort of specialized. I mean, that was sort of a one-man clinic in those days. I would just go do things. I would grab a bunch of students and have them help me out. And we had a wonderful time doing it. But I think because I liked it, I wasn't paying a price for it. Mm-hmm. I think today's, if you're a young professor being hired today and you want to make your mark, I think it's difficult.
Yeah.
I think because you have to, the scholarship has to be first rate. You have to really work at it. And of course you have to be a good teacher. But I think what loses out is public service.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a conscious decision to play down public service, but it's just the realities of a young academic's life. So in my case, I've just had the good fortune, first in Virginia, and then abroad. And since that time, I mean, I can't turn around without getting a call from Richmond. Governors, attorneys general. I just had an email yesterday from a staff member of one of the legislators in Richmond who wants me to help him sort out a really complicated problem of the relation of the governor to the legislature in the veto process.
Yeah.
And it's very complicated. I don't live down there and watch it happen every day. You know, I have to stop and really think about it and go back. And of course, all of this is pro bono. I mean, if I got emails that said, we'd be happy to pay you handsomely, I think the pain would be less. I think I could handle. But, you know, I'm like a public utility, the water you turn on, you know. Oh, yes, you teach at the University of Virginia. It's a state law school.
You're
on the public payroll.
Of course,
you're supposed to help me, the legislator or the executive official, out. So, and it's usually they're interesting questions. I mean, I enjoy doing this stuff, but there are only so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
And I should say no more of the time than I do.
Okay, well, that's a natural segue. So the last question I want to ask, I mean, one interesting thing over our discussion now is that the kind of through line of each of these, you've gone to, you know, to Richmond a lot, gone to Eastern Europe, but you're always coming back here.
That's right.
Why do you think that you've spent your entire career here, and what makes this place special? Why,
well, you know, it's also the question of why so long?
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
60 years?
My 60th year, as far as I know, the record holder before that time was John Minor, who taught from 1845 to 1895, 50 years, and that includes the Civil War when the school wasn't even open, but he was the record holder. His bust is in the library. I've left him in the dust. 10 years ago. Now, why in the world would I? I mean, there's so. I love to travel. I have a family. I have friends. There's so much to do that I like doing. Why in the world would I hang around here and keep on teaching? I really love it. If you had told me when I started teaching that I would, first place, I'd even be here teaching 60 years later, I would say, Charles, you've been smoking something. You know, that's just not going to happen. And if you further said you will enjoy it as much as you did the first year you taught, I'd say you're quite mad. You've taken leave of your senses. I can honestly say that I enjoy the classroom and my students as much now as I did then. I mean, they just are constantly refreshing. It's like a fountain of youth.
Yeah.
It's just amazing because, now I'm not sure if I'd been teaching at some other school like Berkeley or NYU or you pick a school, I'm not sure it would have turned out that way. I mean, I'm sure I would have enjoyed it, but would I feel the same passion for it? I'm not sure I would, because it is UVA.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all of us students and faculty, we tell people how special the UVA and the law school are. You do it yourself to your friends, but you come here and you settle into this place. Sometimes it happens on admitted student weekend, right? You get a kind of a sense of the place. I remember having a conversation with one of our graduates who's now clerking for Justice Kavanaugh. She went to UVA undergraduate law school here, and she had done some work for me as an undergraduate, so I knew her very well. She could have gotten into any law school in the country, and her final choice was UVA and Yale. Well, typically when people have that choice, statistically the break typically is towards Yale, right? People do that. I knew her well enough to try to sit down with her and have a long conversation. I mean, I couldn't be completely impartial, obviously, but I was trying to talk to her in her own interest. I said, you are the kind of person, she was first in her class, by the way. here at the law school. But I said, you know, all doors, you're going to open any door you like. Your future is assured, whether you go to UVA or Yale. But I said, I know you well enough to think that you will prosper in every sense as a human being at UVA. You will like it better. It's 3 years of your life that's certainly worth something. And she came here. Yale was blown away. The dean had called her. Kavanaugh, who was then a judge, had called her. I mean, it was just, they put the big press on her, and she came here. She absolutely knows she did the right thing. She's just one, I give one example of many I could give, of the reality of the specialness of this place. I mean, I ought to turn it over to these folks who are students now, and they could probably answer the question better than I. But I am persuaded in the bottom of my heart that UVA is different, in that sense better, but certainly special.
Well, I agree, but the culture of a place is a product of the people there, and there's no person who's had a greater impress on this institution than you. So we have been lucky to have you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.